Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. The series is inspired by the programming of the piece, The Revolution of Steve Jobs at the Atlanta Opera in the spring of 2022. In preparation for the premiere of the show in Austin, Kansas City, and in Atlanta, we will have a series of interviews with business leaders, opera impresarios, artists, and strategic thinkers, as well as creative minds who will focus on two themes. Number one, the business of opera and the role of leadership in this business. And number two, the very controversial and mysterious character of Steve Jobs and the opera written about him. I'm here today with an amazing professor from Harvard Business School, Professor Rohit Deshpande. And just a little bit of background about him before we start our conversation. During my time at the Program of Leadership Development, the executive program at Harvard Business School, Professor Deshpande was one of the star professors and gave some unforgettable classes in marketing and one class that I'll never forget about ethics in business that really influenced a lot of my cohorts, including myself, and the way we think about business. Professor Deshpande is teaching now at another program at Harvard Business School, the Advanced Management Program with Professor Michael Tushman, and is also a board member of ART in Boston, and is, in addition to many other things that he's doing, he's leading a course of arts and cultural entrepreneurship. He's a lover of arts. He's a lover of classical music. He's a lover of theater. And he is a professor of business, so I look forward to speaking with him. Welcome, Professor Deshpande.
Thank you, Tomer. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And it's a pleasure and an honor and a privilege to be with you in this particular context. Thank you.
Let's start with the obvious question. We live in strange, ridiculous times. As we record this, we're in October of 2021. What is it, 18 months? Maybe even 20 months now after the pandemic started. How have you been?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we focus a lot on the downsides, and let me focus on the upside. The upside is that quarantine allowed us, I think, time to reflect. You know, we live such crazy lives. I mean, you understand this better than most of us do with your life. Juggling so many things and then forced not to juggle and to put the juggling balls down and actually to think about yourself and your life and your identity and your family and your children. In my case, my students. I think it was just a wonderful opportunity. It was gifted time. And I think a lot of us have come out of the quarantine. We're still in the pandemic, but we've come out of the quarantine, hopefully with a more reflective sense of the world and our places within it.
Excellent. And it feels like this was a gift that was only applicable in the first few months, because I found that as time goes by, we learn how to juggle things in a different way, right? So if at first we thought, oh, we have so much time now to spend on ourselves, and now with the virtual world, we find a way to get as busy as ever. That's at least what I think.
Yeah. So, you know, necessity, they say, is the mother of invention. And it was necessary for us to innovate new ways of communicating, new ways of relating to people, new ways to work in teams using technology. Expanding our focus beyond our neighborhoods to the globe, because all of a sudden we had, you know, audiences that were global rather than just local or regional. So I think we've learned a whole bunch of things coming into this phase, as you so rightly put it, of the pandemic.
One of the reasons I was so excited to get to know you and learn about you and your interest is that you obviously are immersed in business and the theory of business. You teach that in Harvard, and you're also a performing arts fanatic. You love classical music, you love theater, and you think about how those two sometimes conflicting worlds live together. They say that there's no business like show business, but it's still a business. So tell us a little bit about how you view it. How do you view the performing arts as a business?
So let me preface my comment with a little context. As you know, I teach along with a colleague here at Harvard a graduate course called Cultural Entrepreneurship, which is just a fancy term for the business of the arts. And I know this is about the business of opera, so that's actually, it's right central of what we do in this course, is about the business of the arts. And the course is about half the students are MBA students, half the students are graduate students from across Harvard University. And the course is applying business concepts to the arts. And that's how we designed the course, Tober. You know, what might be useful frameworks, tools from the business world, and I'll give you an example in just a moment, that could be usefully applied to arts organizations that they're not currently thinking about. So that was, as we went into this, and we're now about to start the fourth year teaching it, we realized that there was actually a huge contribution that the arts and culture world could potentially make to the business world, which was kind of a revelation for us, because we thought of it as a one-way flow of concepts. And all of a sudden, we started thinking about, oh, this is a two-way. So I came up with a template to use in the course, and I call it something borrowed, something new. You know, this is from, so let me give you an example to make it real. So one of the central concepts, as you know, in business is the notion of creating value, right? I mean, we ask ourselves, for instance, in marketing, are we creating value for our customers? Are we creating value for our audiences? If we're not creating value, how can we ask them to subscribe for a season? What is the value? You know, how do we think about the value creation process in the arts? A lot of arts organizations, in my limited experience, have not thought about this concept. They just assume that arts are something that everyone will want, and so we don't have to really think about creating value. You've innovated a lot around this concept of creating value. So that's one that we've been using through the course, teaching our students. All right, now what if this organization were to think about creating value? But the other concept, which in some ways is more powerful, I think, comes from the arts world, and I call it creating values. Values. Because think about it, you know, whether it's music, whether it's dance, whether it's art, painting, these are all surfacing of societal values. Right. So when Monet was painting water lilies, he was evoking what was considered to be beautiful in that context for that time in that place. Now, we still consider that to be amazingly amongst the most amazing set of paintings ever. But at that time, he was creating values. And I think businesses can think more about not only value creation, but values creation. What is it that businesses are doing, or maybe not doing, but what is it that they can do to be thinking about values? What is the context of society in which they operate? So that's an example of a concept. And we have many such ideas through the course that we talk about.
Well, I think that's really, you're hitting it on the head with value and values, because for profit are focused on profits. Like, the value is pretty simple. It's like, there's expenses, there's revenue, let's maximize the revenue. So they don't often think about values beyond that. And I think there's a lot of examples right now, from privacy to how do you make sure that information is correct. But in the arts, and this is where it's fascinating to me, it's tricky to apply a for-profit logic on non-for-profit. Because non-for-profit base their revenue mostly on contributions and a little bit on earned revenue from ticket sales. And so in the business world, that makes no sense. I mean, one of the things I remember from my time in Harvard is my colleagues, my cohorts going, what do you mean your ticket sales are only 30% of your income? That doesn't make any sense. And so how do you, as a professor of business, bring those two together? How do you reconcile the for-profit logic with non-for-profit?
You know, we can either separate the worlds and say there's for-profit, not-for-profit. To me, that's a tax status issue. You know, it's a tax status issue, for-profit and non-profit. No. What do they have in common? They have audiences in common. They need to engage in common. They need to move from transactions to relationships in common. So I think it profits us, it benefits us, if we think more about the commonalities rather than differences.
The question that I have to you is, when you think about arts organizations, it's already difficult to figure out the financial situation and to focus on the financial situation to make it sustainable. You mentioned that all that we are talking about, from creating value in podcasts to digital streaming, for example, is new right now.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that people that run organizations have a solid direction in terms of what they're choosing to focus on? Let me unpack that for a second. So I'm choosing to record this podcast right now. I have a crew of folks that are working on it, and we're choosing to spend resources on that. How do we know that this is the right thing to do? There are many, many people in my position running arts organization asking themselves the same question. Should we focus on analog? Should we just focus on live performances, which is what we've always done? Or should we create value in other ways? What is your advice to those folks?
Yeah. So I'll take you back to fundamental concepts and strategy that we understand. So, you know, this goes back to what the mission of the organization is. You know, it fundamentally, who are you and what is your place in the world? You know, if you think about your mission, so all of these different forms of communication or engagement, or potentially revenue, are they on mission or not? Are they on mission or not? So I'll give you an example. One of the organizations that our students work with here in Boston is the BSO, the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I remember in a meeting with Mark Volpe, who is the CEO of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, at the beginning of the pandemic, when they shut down, they went dark, Symphony Hall went dark like you did. We were talking about it, and he said, you know, we have to fundamentally rethink who we are as BSO, who we are. And I think of us not as a symphony orchestra. I think of us as a media business, mm-hmm. as a media mm-hmm. business. And at the time, I was struck by this. I said, wow, that's a pretty far cry, you know, as a media business. I mean, Disney is a media business. What does that have to do with the Boston Symphony? But as you have yourself done with the Atlanta Opera, all of a sudden now digital streaming, you know, you've had to develop muscle in areas in which you don't have any expertise. You've had to bring in people. You had to train yourself. Digital streaming. And then that's just the channel. Now, how do you monetize it?
That's the question.
That's the question, right? Yeah. Like, no, what do we do? So I think we begin by saying, Are there lessons we can learn from other organizations that are outside of our industry or our sector that we can maybe adapt and adopt? Adapt to our nonprofit context and then adopt, right? So I'll give you an example from a classical musician whom you know rather well. Yo-Yo Ma. During the pandemic, Yo-Yo Ma started broadcasting from his study in his home here in Boston. And he called it Songs of Comfort. So he would play something just himself, you know, on camera, like this, right? Sound quality was fantastic because he had people who could advise him on it. So that was phase one where he was doing this. And the next phase was, and this was free. The next phase was he monetized it. So the next thing was that he was on a platform called, I think it's a German platform called Idagio, if I remember
right.
Right. Which I was not aware of, and I became aware of because I'm on his Facebook mailing page, list. I noticed. And so what was that? So basically what he did was he played for an hour, maybe Beethoven, he plays for an hour. It was like €9, let's say $10, right? And he plays for an hour, and then there was some Q&A. And this time, instead of doing it from his home, he would do it from the Fraser Performance Hall in GBH, our public radio station, TV station here in Boston. Now, think about the monetization, right? I don't know how many seats there are in Symphony Hall. Let's say there are 2,000 seats in Symphony Hall, right? Let's say the average ticket, they range, but I don't know. What would you say would be the average ticket for a Yo-Yo Ma concert in Symphony Hall?
It's $100.
Okay, so 100, right? So that's 2,000 multiplied by 100, right? So now just do the math on that. If it's $10 instead of 100, you just need, not just, but you need a multiple of 10. Mm-hmm. 10 times the audience. But now, instead of having one fixed structure, which is Symphony Hall in Boston, you are now broadcasting to the globe. You can easily make that number, and you can probably expand it way beyond. Now, yes,
Theoretically.
Yes, I understand this is Yo-Yo Ma, you know, who is I have just pure admiration for him.
Me
as
too.
Not only as a wonderful musician, but also as a human being. There aren't very many Yo-Yo Ma's, unfortunately, in the world. But it's an example of what an innovator can do, of taking something that seems like the end of the world and actually converting it into an opportunity and actually monetizing it.
And I think it's right on the money in terms of what we're struggling with, because there are many arts organizations that during the pandemic realized that the only way that they could connect with people was digital. And then they realized the possibilities that are connected with digital. Now, digital has some challenges. There's no replacement for live performance. There's no replacement for the community, for the live sound. There are multiple competitions in the digital world on your time and your attention.
Yeah.
But there is tremendous value in investing in digital. The question is, once the pandemic is gone and all those analog performing arts organizations are back into performing live, there is huge challenge in splitting your attention between trying to do operas, live operas, or live concerts, or live plays, and creating digital content, original digital content that is solely for consumption via digital channels. How do you determine how to spend your resources, how to spend your money, is a huge question. And that takes me into what you actually teach in Harvard Business School, what Professor Tushman keeps talking about, this idea of explore versus exploit, because in a way, live performance is the exploited product and digital is the exploratory product. Now, there's a chance that they can cannibalize from each other if you don't do that carefully. How do you see the future moving forward as we emerge from the pandemic? Is there a world where those two can live together?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we've been experimenting with this in education, as you know, for a very, very long time with online, right? So we have free online called MOOCs, massive open online classrooms. And then we have monetized online also with shorter, especially Harvard Business School, you know, shorter programs. And we've been very careful to actually avoid cannibalization by targeting carefully which audiences we are communicating with and the nature of the product itself. Okay. What it's also made us do, and much more so now during the pandemic than pre-pandemic, although we were already experimenting with online pre-pandemic, was made us really think about what is the value that we create in the classroom that we cannot create online. What is it? So I'll give you just one example of that. And we've been thinking, you mentioned that I'm on the advisory board of the American Repertory Theater. We've been thinking a lot about this at the ART. The concept of community audience, as opposed to individual. So I can watch a digital stream sitting at home of a particular play. So I can watch The Tempest, Shakespeare's Tempest, for instance. And then I have, say, I also the alternative of going to the ART, sitting in a theater with other people. There is no comparison between those experiences. One is an individualized experience, and the other is a community shared experience. It's like watching Netflix by yourself versus going into a cinema theater, to use the film example. Those are two completely different. And because they're completely different experiences, two things fall out from that. One is monetization. That is, the pricing should be different because the experiences are different. And the second thing that falls out is you need to segment your audience. There's a certain audience that likes the comfort and safety and security of their home and having all of the freedom of choice of all of these offerings. And there's another audience that says, you know what? There's nothing that can replace live theater or live opera. I want to be in there. That experience moves me in a way that watching something on a computer screen will never move me. Those are different audiences. Now, I want to add one little piece in here, which is thinking about the technology. You know, we're thinking about this as a dissemination channel. So we've got, you know, live opera with one channel, and then we've got something on a computer screen, another channel. I think we need to move beyond that to think about engagement. So if we think about technology, how do we engage more? And I realize this requires resources, but this is the future. We need to think about virtual. We need to think about augmented reality. We need to think about 3D ways of actually showing the performance. I mean, if you think about that wonderful performance of Hamilton that appeared on Disney Plus, mm-hmm. right, where they filmed that. Incredible. And it was an experiment because they filmed that before the pandemic and then they were ready to go with it, which is why Disney paid that multiple to buy that. Now, think about if they had actually done that with virtual reality, augmented reality, where the viewer has the ability to actually control how they view the actor or actors. They can go around, they can go to the back, they can go to the front. Those are things you can't do sitting in the theater. In a sense, it's what we call breaking the fourth wall. It's breaking the fourth wall. It's allowing the audience to come in and see what you've done. You know, it's like you're bored going behind the scenes and actually seeing the set before the opera begins. So they can actually, you've actually broken the fourth wall with that group of people that you lead on that tour. What if technology allowed you to do that? So that's technology. And then it turns out that there's a certain audience that actually wants to do that. They tend to be younger audiences. They tend to be millennials that are much more interested in breaking that wall.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we talked so much about the challenges in this new world, the post-corona world, and how to make the performing arts sustainable and innovative. And one of the major things that you focus on, that Harvard Business School executive programs are focusing on, is leadership. And this podcast is actually inspired by the fact that we're doing an opera about Steve Jobs, a very controversial leader. You mentioned in our discussion a wonderful artist, Yo-Yo Ma, who you admire greatly. I know you're working with a fantastic artistic director, Diane Paulus. As you think about leaders, specifically in the performing arts, and they're all dealing with tremendous challenges that we just discussed, what is your advice to them would be?
Yeah, so it goes back to how our conversation started and how earlier conversations, Tomer, have started. And that is, what can leaders learn from organizations outside of their industries and outside of their sectors? You know, what lessons for how to lead successfully, not just an opera or not just a theater or not just a museum, but how do you lead in an uncertain world, in a very volatile world? What can we learn? And I think we need to go beyond our sectors. And that's one of the reasons why I'm such a big believer in the case method. You may or may not know that this year is the 100th year of the case method being taught at the Harvard Business School. And so we're reflecting a lot about that. And one of the wonderful things, many wonderful things about the case method is that it takes you out of your own world and your own sector and puts you into another world, another sector. As a student, you're asked to pretend that you are the protagonist in that organization. What would you do? That's how you learn. You know, I don't have the kinds of limits and constraints that I have in my organization. What if I were in this one? Is there something that I can learn? And then you say, you know, adapt, adopt. How can I bring this? You're absolutely right. You can't bring everything in because you have a certain context that's very important to understand. But there are certain concepts that people haven't, that leaders have not used in your industry, in your sector. And this may be, you know, a way to do it.
Absolutely.
And the time to do it.
And I think that the case method is especially powerful in an executive program because the people that are attending are not theoretical students. No, when you study for an MBA at 22, your chances to run an organization or to be a huge part of moving an organization forward strategically are not going to come until 10 years from your graduation, maybe if you're lucky 5 years. And by then you may forget a lot of the things that you studied. But if you study as in an executive program, you have a chance to really apply immediately what you're learning from those case studies on your own organization.
Yeah, not to mention the networking of other leaders who are in the same program, who are facing similar challenges, and maybe have successfully solved some of those challenges that you can learn from them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, this has been an amazing opportunity to connect with you. Every chance I have to do that, I relish, Professor. And thank you so much for your time. I look forward to seeing you in one of our performances.
Tomer, thank you so much for inviting me. And let me again add my thanks to your team, Aaron and Liam, for organizing this technology that I was not aware of before. So thank you all. These things work best in collaboration, and I'm very happy to be part of your collaborative effort here. And I look forward to seeing the product of what you're doing.